all things essential to mutual progress, implied both economic integration and social segregation. But he insisted that the vote would not long be withheld from a race acquiring skills, learning, and property. Washington's philosophy of accommodation struck many black intellectuals as craven, yet his career showed how it could be turned to advantage. Where once little Booker had crawled on packed dirt and endured slave shirts that stung his skin, Big Booker now summered in wealthy New England resorts and ruled a multi-million-dollar educational empire. The Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute of Alabama, the black teacher training college he had founded in 1881, was a huge and thriving enterprise financed by eager philanthropists. Through the Tuskegee machine, his secret fraternity of academics, businessmen, preachers, politicians, and journalists, he controlled most of the nation's Negro newspapers and political platforms. Washington was the most powerful black man in America, and to Theodore Roosevelt, who tended to equate power with creativity, a genius such as does not arise in a generation. Exactly what his full ambition was, nobody knew. Courteous yet inscrutable, he operated on many levels. Roosevelt, gazing at him with blind, patrician eyes, saw only a chunky yellow man of quiet speech and deferential manner. Washington, gazing back, saw himself reflected quite otherwise in the president's spectacles, a double image of anger and power, wholly, bitterly black. No sooner had he returned to Alabama than the patronage agreement he had with Roosevelt was put to the test. A federal district court judge died in Montgomery, not far from Tuskegee. Washington swung into immediate action. The vacancy could best be filled, he wrote the president, by Thomas G. Jones, a former governor of the state. He stood up in the Constitutional Convention and elsewhere for a fair election law, opposed lynching, and he has been outspoken for the education of both races. He is head and shoulders above any of the other persons who I think will apply for the position. Jones also happened to be a Democrat. Roosevelt received the last piece of information with modified rapture. He would have preferred a Republican judge to begin with, if only to lull Senator Hanna into a false sense of security. This important appointment would be seen as a prototype of his future patronage policy. Hanna was bound to suggest someone from the lily-white wing of the GOP. A dilemma then loomed. If Roosevelt accepted Hanna's recommendation, he would look like a puppet in his first major presidential act and perpetuate the Southern status quo. If he appointed Governor Jones, a racial moderate who had fought under Lee, he would gratify Negroes while persuading Southern Democrats that their long exile from political privilege was over. Morally, his course was clear, yet the politician in him hesitated. Washington sent an aide, Emmett J. Scott, to the White House to press the appointment. Scott reported that the president was cordial yet cagey. He wanted to know if Governor Jones supported Bryan. I told him no. He wanted to know how I knew. I told him of the letter wherein he, Governor Jones, stated to you that he had not supported Bryan, etc., etc. Well, he said he wanted to hear from you direct. Washington was forced to investigate and reply with some embarrassment that if Jones had never actively supported the commoner, he had cast a vote for him in 1900. Scott delivered the telegram to Roosevelt. Surprise and chagrin struggled on the president's face. He paced up and down. Well, I guess I'll have to appoint him, but I am awfully sorry he voted for Bryan. So was Mark Hanna when the appointment was announced on 7 October. He heard the news at home in Ohio and demanded to know why Roosevelt had acted without consulting him. The president replied frankly, "Because my experience has taught me that in such a case, a quick decision really prevents bitterness." Hanna wrote back in the tones of a patient but miffed mentor. Roosevelt must go slow until he got back to town. There were bound to be many applicants for federal favor in the weeks ahead. Reserve your decision, unless in cases which may require immediate action. Then, if my advice is of importance, Cordelieu can reach me over the long distance. Despite Hannah's concern, praise for the appointment of Judge Jones was both loud and bipartisan. The Atlanta Constitution proclaimed itself electrified with hope of a new day. Three wealthy young white Republicans in Montgomery, Alabama, announced that they were forming a Roosevelt Club to revolutionize and revitalize GOP politics. Review of Reviews declared that Roosevelt had immensely strengthened the real and permanent interests of his party. Encouraged, the president began to indulge some official vanities. He ordered three glossy carriages and five new horses, and commissioned a patriotic new livery, consisting of blue coat, white doeskin trousers, high boots, and top hat with tricolor cockade. He scrapped the old executive mansion letterhead with its Gothic curlicues and replaced it with stationery proclaiming the White House in plain sans serif. He made free use of his power of summons. John Hay, hobbling over daily from the State Department, complained that one interview a month had been enough for McKinley. Roosevelt, in any case, did not seem to need much help with foreign policy. He was already formulating it. His first diplomatic document was a 3,000-word set of instructions for delegates to the International Conference of American States. Behind the show and the energy, Hay detected incipient signs of noblesse oblige. "Stay away if you want to be amused," he wrote Henry Adams in Europe. "Teddy said the other day, 'I am not going to be the slave of tradition that forbids presidents from seeing friends. I am going to dine with you and Henry Adams and Cabot whenever I like.' But," here the shadow of the crown sobered him a little, "of course I must preserve the prerogative of the initiative." Most observers felt that Roosevelt had exercised the prerogative wisely during his first month in office. He had consoled and inspired a stricken country, steadied the stock market, established decent standards of patronage, and tempered the mutual hatreds of race and party. While doing these things in the name of continuity, he had somehow managed to hint at a future bright with possibilities of reform. It remained to be seen whether he was not, perhaps, enjoying too much success too soon. "For the moment, all America praises the new president," a British correspondent wrote, "but trouble is bound to come." Chapter 2. The Most Damnable Outrage. Thousands of men who wouldn't have voted for him under any circumstances has declared that under no circumstances would they vote for him now. On 16 October 1901, the president heard that Booker T. Washington was back in town and invited him to dine that night in the White House. Roosevelt had a momentary qualm about being the first president ever to entertain a black man in the White House. His hesitancy made him ashamed of himself, and all the more determined to break more than a century of precedent. He received Washington at 7:30 p.m. and introduced him to Edith. The only other non-family guest was Philip B. Stewart, a friend from Colorado. Dinner proceeded behind closed doors, under the disapproving gaze of a Negro butler. Southern politics was the main topic of conversation. Washington's aloofness precluded friendly chat, as did Edith Roosevelt's sweet uninterest in anyone, black or white, who was not, as she put it, de notre monde. The president felt entirely at ease. It seemed so natural and so proper to have Washington wield his silver. Here, dark and dignified among the paler company, was living proof of what he had always preached, that Negroes could rise to the social heights, at least on an individual basis. Collective equality was clearly out of the question, given their natural limitations in the evolutionary scheme of things. But a black man who advanced faster than his fellows should be rewarded with every privilege that democracy could bestow. Booker T. Washington qualified honoris causa in the aristocracy of worth. For those blacks who did not, Roosevelt had little political sympathy. The Georgian blood of his unreconstructed mother persuaded him that the 15th Amendment had been a mistake, and that, in 9 cases out of 10, disenfranchisement was justified. Blacks were better suited for service than suffrage. On the whole, they were altogether inferior to the whites. Yet Roosevelt believed, as most Americans did not, that this inferiority was temporary. The arguments of Charles Darwin, Jean Lamarck, and Gustave Le Bon convinced him that Washington's race was merely adolescent, as his own had been in the 17th century. Negro advancement must necessarily be painful. Witness the scars on Washington's face, his air of swarthy suffering. But equality would come, as black Americans, generation by generation, acquired the civilized characteristics of whites. It was crucial that these voteless millions should begin to feel working for them those often unseen forces in the national life which are greater than all legislation. Just how unseen should Washington be in his new role as presidential advisor? Even now, the secretive Tuskegee was preparing to slip out of town on a midnight train. Could Roosevelt rely on him to spread the word to Negroes that the federal government was on their side? Sometime during the last moments of the day, after Washington had left and before Roosevelt went to bed, an Associated Press reporter stopped by the White House to ask, routinely, about the day's guest list. By 2 a.m., a one-sentence dispatch was humming round the country. Booker T. Washington of Tuskegee, Alabama, dined with the president last evening. Neither Roosevelt nor Washington could complain about Negro reactions to this release when it appeared in the morning newspapers. Untimely congratulations warmed them, like sunbeams before a storm. "Greatest step for the race in a generation," a black man telegraphed from Nashville. "The hour is at hand," another rejoiced, "to make the beginning of a new order." A third, who remembered young Theodore Roosevelt, skinny and shaky, seconding the nomination of a Negro to chair the 1884 Republican Convention, told him, "Your act in honoring Washington was a masterly stroke of statesmanship, worthy of the best minds this country has produced." And at a humbler level of black opinion, federal messenger boys discussed the dinner in excited whispers. Whites, too, reacted favorably, at least those of liberal instinct, but during the afternoon distant rumblings warned that a political hurricane was on its way up from the south. An early thunderclap was sounded by the Memphis Scimitar. "The most damnable outrage which has ever been perpetrated by any citizen of the United States was committed yesterday by the President when he invited a nigger to dine with him at the White House. It would not be worth more than a passing notice if Theodore Roosevelt had sat down to dinner in his own home with a Pullman car porter, but Roosevelt the individual and Roosevelt the President are not to be viewed in the same light. It is only very recently that President Roosevelt boasted that his mother was a Southern woman, and that he is half Southern by reason of that fact. By inviting a nigger to his table, he pays his mother small duty. No Southern woman with a proper self-respect would now accept an invitation to the White House, nor would President Roosevelt be welcomed today in Southern homes. He has not inflamed the anger of the Southern people. He has excited their disgust." The word nigger had not been seen in print for years. Its sudden reappearance had the force of an obscenity. Within hours, newspapers from the Piedmont to the Yazoo were raining it and other racial epithets on the president's head. "Roosevelt dines a darkie, a rank negrophilist, our coon-flavored president. Roosevelt proposes to coddle the sons of Ham." Some of the more sensational sheets expressed sexual disgust at the idea of Edith Roosevelt and Washington touching thighs, so to speak, under the table. The president was accused of promoting a mingling and mongrelization of the Anglo-Saxon race. Booker T. Washington was sarcastically advised to send his daughter to the White House for Christmas. "Maybe Roosevelt's son will fall in love with her and marry her." The storm squalled louder when reporters discovered that Roosevelt had entertained blacks before in the gubernatorial mansion at Albany and at Sagamore Hill. Hate mail and death threats swamped the White House and the Tuskegee Institute. In Richmond, Virginia, a transparency of the president's face was hissed off the bijou screen. In Charleston, South Carolina, Senator Benjamin R. Tillman endorsed remedial genocide. "The action of President Roosevelt in entertaining that nigger will necessitate our killing 1,000 niggers in the South before they will learn their place again." Roosevelt was dumbfounded by the violence his invitation had provoked. At first, he blamed Bourbon extremists. Yet even the most temperate Southern opinion held him in reproof. "At one stroke and by one act," the Richmond News declared, "he has destroyed the kindly, warm regard and personal affection for him, which were growing up fast in the South. Hereafter, it will be impossible to feel, as we were beginning to feel, that he is one of us." By tacit agreement, Roosevelt and Washington refused to discuss their dinner with reporters. The president sent private word to Tuskegee that he did not care what anybody thought or said about it. Both men were buoyed, however, by the continuing support of Northern newspapers. The Springfield Republican remarked that while Roosevelt's gesture may have been an indiscretion, it was splendid in its recognition of the essential character of the presidential office. On 21 October, another lightning report flashed through the South. The President and Booker T. Washington were to dine together again at Yale University's bicentennial. What was more, Miss Alice Roosevelt would probably join them. Yale issued a denial. Dr. Washington was merely scheduled to march behind Roosevelt in the academic procession. But too late to still the uproar in Dixie. "The whole South," a nervous white minister wrote, "has not been so deeply moved in 20 years. Roosevelt looked calm and purposeful as he traveled through Connecticut on 23 October. The Secret Service, however, was noticeably apprehensive when he reached the Yale campus. In view of what had happened the last time a president had accepted public handshakes, he was forbidden to work the crowd. Shocked by this restriction, Roosevelt seemed to realize his personal and political danger for the first time. He averted his eyes from Washington during their march to Hyperion Theater. A revised security plan seated them far apart, with the Negro in the audience and Roosevelt himself on the stage. No reference to their dinner was made during the ensuing speeches, but cheers filled the hall when Supreme Court Justice David J. Brewer invoked the Father of the Nation and remarked, "Thank God there have always been in this country college men able to recognize a true Washington, though his first name be not George." Degrees were awarded to a distinguished list of honorees, including John Hay, Elihu Root, Woodrow Wilson, and the white-suited Mark Twain. "One name yet remains," President Arthur Hadley intoned, and was unable to continue, so loud was the roar for Theodore Roosevelt. Notwithstanding this expression of support, Roosevelt declined to see Washington later in the day. At a public reception that evening, he sat aloof, kneading his silk hat. He seized on Twain and asked whether it had been right to invite a Negro to the White House. The novelist, speaking carefully, said that a president was perhaps not as free as an ordinary citizen to entertain whomever he liked. Twain's private opinion was that Roosevelt should refrain from offending the nation merely to advertise himself and make a noise. A large crowd awaited the arrival of the presidential train in Washington the next morning. Few eyes followed Roosevelt as he stepped down to the platform. Attention was riveted on Alice, pausing prettily behind him. The rumor, false or not, that she had been willing to eat with a Negro was scandalous, and the slenderness of her body, in its wine-colored traveling dress, sent agreeable signals of sex. Newsmen ogled her with pleased anticipation as she followed her father out of the station, a bunch of violets nodding in her belt. Here, manifestly, was copy for many seasons. Roosevelt's querulousness about his dinner invitation did not abate in the days ahead. While maintaining a public silence, he admitted to friends that he was puzzled and depressed. He had only wanted to show some little respect to an esteemed fellow American. White Southerners could abuse him if they chose. I regard their attacks with the most contemptuous indifference, but I am very melancholy that such a feeling should exist in such bitterly aggravated form. As for Booker T. Washington, I shall have him to dine just as often as I please. Some of these remarks may have reached Washington's ears, for a polite letter came from Tuskegee. My dear Mr. President, I have refrained writing you regarding the now famous dinner which both of us ate so innocently until I could get to the South and study the situation at first hand. Since coming here and getting into real contact with the white people, I am convinced of three things. In the first place, I believe that a great deal is being made of the incident because of the elections which are now pending in several of the southern states. And in the second place, I do not believe the matter is felt as seriously as the newspapers try to make it appear. And in the third place, I am more than ever convinced that the wise course is to pursue exactly the policy which you mapped out in the beginning. Not many moons will pass before you will find the South in the same attitude toward you that it was a few years ago. That attitude, however, had always been skeptical. Sensing Roosevelt's need for reassurance, Washington wrote again to say that the controversy was providential, even therapeutic. I cannot help but feel that good is going to come out of it. That attitude, however, had always been skeptical. Sensing Roosevelt's need for reassurance, Washington wrote again to say that the controversy was providential, even therapeutic. I cannot help but feel that good is going to come out of it. Some good, certainly, accrued to himself. His reception by the President had transformed him into a political force of the first magnitude. Booker T. Washington now commanded the fear, as well as the love, of black Americans. Eventually, the former emotion might qualify the latter, but for the time being he was king of a captive people. Roosevelt's gains were more negative. He had learned the evanescence of presidential popularity, the complexity of race prejudice, and the infinite capacity of the newspaper press to manufacture sensations. He had to accept that he had no real constituency in the South and stood little chance of assembling one, so united were Democrats against him. Perhaps his dream of bipartisan reform had always been quixotic. The most he could hope was that Southern blacks would reward his goodwill at the next national convention. The summer of 1904, however, seemed far away in the fall of 1901. Roosevelt could only lament his sudden misfortune and the revival of old doubts about his maturity. A 43rd candle on his birthday cake on 27 October did not console him, nor the gift of a possum from some black admirers. He dutifully announced that he would wait until the first frosty day before eating his critter, well browned and with sweet potatoes on the side. But his private melancholy persisted through the first week of November. I have not been able to think out any solution of the terrible problem offered by the presence of the Negro on this continent, but of one thing I am sure, and that is that inasmuch as he is here and can neither be killed nor driven away, the only wise and honorable and Christian thing to do is treat each black man and each white man strictly on his merits as a man. Of course, I know that we see through a glass, dimly, and, after all, it may be that I am wrong. But if I am, then all my thoughts and beliefs are wrong, and my whole way of looking at life is wrong. At any rate, while I am in public life, however short a time it may be, I am in honor bound to act up to my beliefs and convictions. As the famous dinner receded into memory and mythology, Roosevelt grew more conciliatory toward his critics, admitting that he might, just possibly, have made a mistake, but only in the political sense. Morally speaking, my action was absolutely proper. He kept his vow to consult Booker T. Washington on matters of race and patronage, but never again asked him to dinner, and when Washington next visited the White House, George Cortelyou was careful to schedule the appointment at 10 o'clock on a regular business morning. Chapter 3. One Vast, Smoothly Running Machine. Mr. Dooley, a hard time the rich have in giant life. Mr. Hennessy, I'd trade with them. Mr. Dooley, I would not. 'Tis too much like hard work. The night of Monday, 11 November 1901, was moonless, and shadows drowned the canyons of downtown New York City. Wall Street, darkest canyon of all, was deserted except for a group of carriages waiting outside the house of Morgan. Midnight struck, then 1 o'clock. Inside the gloomy building, behind successive ramparts of granite, mahogany, and ground glass, three financiers conferred. James J. Hill and E. H. Harriman habitually shunned the light of day, the flash and glare of publicity. As for J. Pierpont Morgan, the third party to the business at hand, his aloofness was so Olympian that he was not even present. An aide, George W. Perkins, negotiated in his stead. This common need for seclusion had little to do with shyness, although Morgan's carbuncled nose, Hill's bald pate, and Harriman's wire-spectacled features twitching around a huge damp mustache brought out the worst in small boys and cartoonists. Had the financiers been as gorgeous as gods, their desire would likely still be to operate in private. Combinations, they felt, were best put together quietly. Decent, driven men, they had enriched themselves beyond imagination by anonymous deals in railroad stocks. They had built up great transportation systems, stimulated interstate commerce, and improved life for uncounted millions of people. Their philanthropies were legion, their senses of social responsibility sincere. Yet they had learned with chagrin that the wages of large achievement were public scrutiny and malice. This only made them retreat deeper into themselves. At the heights of their careers, they were a bruised, petulant trio, bent on further organization of the economy, its Morganization in popular parlance. Their meeting tonight demanded especial discretion. It marked the climax of a secret 7-month war between Hill's Great Northern and Harriman's Union Pacific Railroads for control of Morgan's Northern Pacific. Also at stake was the Burlington and Quincy Road connecting the three systems with Chicago. Mere rumors of this Battle of Titans earlier in the year had precipitated the worst panic in Wall Street history. Morgan had been obliged to pump $16 million into the market to save the stock exchange from collapse. Right now, Hill seemed to be winning. Harriman had managed to amass a majority of Northern Pacific preferred shares, but they were due to be retired by forced exchange for common shares on New Year's Day 1902, and Hill, with Morgan's connivance, owned a majority of those. There was no guarantee, however, that Harriman would not challenge the power of those shares in court. If successful, he would end up controlling 4 of America's 6 Western rail networks. That thought was enough to whiten what was left of James J. Hill's hair. At 63, Hill was 10 years older than Harriman. The strain of fighting a ruthless adversary had taken its toll. One horizon-filling vision still haunted him— the combination of the Great Northern, the Northern Pacific, and the Burlington into a rail mega-system covering 17 states and 32,000 miles of track. Harriman alone could prevent that dream from becoming reality. Hill, therefore, had to seduce the little man, as he called him, into some sort of partnership. What lay before them and Perkins was a proposal to create a trust so immense as to absorb the stock of all three railroads, some $400 million worth. These securities would be invested in a holding company, which would act as a conduit for profits and protect the component roads. Harriman would be rewarded with board seats proportionate to his Northern Pacific holdings, free access to the Burlington system, and a huge sum of cash. Hill proposed calling their new trust the Northern Securities Company Limited. Anybody could see from the draft charter that Northern Securities, if incorporated, would be the greatest combination in the world, second only to U.S. Steel. It would earn $100 million a year. Its commerce would extend from Chicago to Seattle, and thence, via Hill shipping lines, as far as China. The flaw in this Colombian scheme was that the Great Northern and Northern Pacific were competitive roads. Mutually operated, they might seem to be acting in restraint of interstate trade, as defined by the Sherman Antitrust Act. But Hill was confident of the legality of his charter. The finest trust attorneys in the country had researched the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Sherman Act and found no precedent to threaten Northern Securities. Indeed, the decision in U.S. v. E.C. Knight seemed to affirm the right of a holding company to acquire competing stocks, whether the result was monopoly or not. The bells of Trinity Church struck 2 o'clock. It was time for a decision. Harriman weighed the cost of further warfare against the profits of truce and pronounced himself perfectly satisfied with Hill's offer. George Perkins agreed to join them on the board of the new trust as representative of the House of Morgan. The three men voted to file for immediate incorporation. Then they went into the night. The next day, Tuesday, 12 November, Roosevelt finished drafting his first annual message to Congress. The task had occupied him, on and off, for more than 7 weeks. He had taken particular pains with the subsection on trusts, and was looking forward to reading it to his cabinet. Secrecy surrounding the formation of Northern Securities lasted a further 24 hours. Not until Wednesday morning did a prominent but vaguely worded announcement of a settlement in the Northern Pacific matter appear in the New York Sun, Morgan's mouthpiece. There was no hint of the formation of a new trust, but more details were promised later in the day. Clearly, the story was so big, Morgan wanted to delay it until after the stock exchange closed. Roosevelt worked until lunchtime. At 1:15, he called for the White House barber. He had an eccentric fondness for being shaved in the early afternoon. Then marched with glowing cheeks into the dining room. He asked the Attorney General of the United States to accompany him. Roosevelt had taken to calling Philander C. Knox his playmate. At first sight, the little lawyer seemed an unlikely candidate for friendship. He was short, smooth, pale, and expressionless, a porcelain egg of a man, weighted in place, yet tilting to the slightest touch. His dark blue eyes stared in different directions. No spoon could crack him open for inspection. In the words of a frustrated interviewer, he offers no point of attack. Knox was the quintessential attorney, ready to argue any brief for a fee. The larger the fee, the better he argued. Happily for him, corporations in his home state of Pennsylvania could afford very large fees indeed. By the time he joined the second McKinley administration, Knox had argued himself into the highest income bracket of the law, and his client list boasted such names as Carnegie, Mellon, and Frick. The Attorney General spent his money well, in nouveau riche style. His first gesture on coming to Washington had been to beat the Count of Monte Cristo's price for a pair of high-stepping horses. He established himself in a lavishly redecorated mansion on K Street, wore pearls at cuffs and collar, and entertained all comers to magnums of Moët et Chandon en Perrier. Although he affected to be bored by his own splendor, Knox worked behind the biggest desk in town and was lobbying for a new palatial Department of Justice building. "I think I shall need a large appropriation. It should be built entirely of marble." His languid laissez-faire law enforcement so far had earned him the nickname Sleepy Phil. Cynics noted that Knox had helped organize U.S. Steel. Henry Adams dismissed him as a Wall Street stooge, sodden with corporate briefs, not realizing that Knox needed instructions in order to function. President McKinley had never supplied them. A friend remarked, "There must be a client. Knox would not know himself without one." Roosevelt was quick to remedy this deficiency. He had asked Knox to help him draft the trust control paragraphs of his message to Congress with encouraging results. I am being advised by the best attorney general this government has ever had. In just 8 weeks, the two men had become fast friends. They could often be seen riding together in Rock Creek Park. Knox, Roosevelt discovered, was a distinguished equestrian. Those high-stepping horses were not just for show. Neither were the thousands of leather volumes in his library. The attorney general was a perpetual, if monotonous, quoter of verse and historical facts. He was polite without being humble, and could be startlingly outspoken. This further endeared him to his client. When a visitor asked the Roosevelt children who their father's favorites were, they drummed their spoons and piped in chorus, "Mr. Root and Mr. Knox." Neither the president nor the attorney general would reveal what they discussed over lunch on 13 November 1901. But since the Hill-Harriman settlement was the day's big news, they probably devoted little time to the weather. Such a truce could portend only one thing: further monopolization of the railroad industry. Roosevelt knew both Hill and Harriman slightly, and Morgan rather better, but he was more concerned with the Sun's revelation that George W. Perkins had been an auxiliary party to the settlement. Perkins was the brightest of J.P. Morgan's golden boys, clever, charming, successful in both insurance and finance, a self-made millionaire at 39. To Roosevelt, he was a close friend, one of the men I most respect. Perkins had come to the White House recently to advise him on the corporate section of his message, along with another Morgan partner, Robert Bacon. Handsome, godlike Bob, who so overshadowed pale Teddy in the Harvard class of 80. It was plain now why they had reacted negatively to his antitrust paragraphs, arguing like attorneys for a bad case. Whatever doubts the president may have had about trust control, he had none now. Perkins may just as well make up his mind that I will not make my message one hair's breadth milder. Morgan, Hill, and Harriman announced the Northern Securities Company late that afternoon. A few evening papers carried the story, but its full impact did not register across the country until Thursday, 14 November. By then, a majority of directors named to the board had approved the conversion and combination of their various stocks, and the giant trust was a fait accompli. The New York Sun praised Hill's charter as broad and masterly. The New York Journal saw it as yet another step toward universal monopoly. Ordinary citizens had lost their capacity to feel rage and terror at such news. All they wanted to know was whether the concentration shall be in the public interests or against them. With heavy irony, the Journal complimented the best business brains in America for advancing socialism's concept of a nationalized industrial state. They are smoothing out all the difficulties, consolidating staffs, and creating one vast, smoothly running machine. When they have finished, all the government will have to do will be to assume the debts of the system, exchange national bonds for stock, and give the general manager a commission from the President of the United States. The irony was lost on George Perkins, who excitedly clipped the column and sent it to Roosevelt. "To me there is a great deal of significance in an editorial of this kind from a paper like the Journal." In due course, both Perkins and Robert Bacon were reported to have joined the board of Northern Securities, balancing the power of Hill and Harriman. Other board members came from the Rockefeller Empire and the Vanderbilt and Gould systems. The complete directorate read like a miniature who's who of finance capitalism. The more Roosevelt and Knox looked at Northern Securities, the more they saw it as a symbol of the arrogant beauty of combination. Unlike U.S. Steel, a smoky picture to most minds of ovens and boilerplate, the new trust was imaginable in detail, length, and breadth. Here was a shining necklace of rails, bejeweled with real estate, spread across America's bosom. What it adorned, it monopolized. Speculators rushed to buy. One of the first was Senator Hanna. "Can I get some of the new holding company stock as an investment?" he begged Perkins. "I asked Mr. Hill to give me some, and he said he would, but I would like more. I wish you would look a little out for me." Lesser citizens, to whom one share, at $110, represented 10 weeks' wages, wondered how a company purporting to operate in Hoboken, New Jersey, could do legitimate business halfway around the globe. The popular journalist Ray Stannard Baker, writing for Collier's Weekly, noted with what humdrum monotony 5 or 6 plutocratic names appeared on the rosters of giant corporations. "You can ride from England to China on regular lines of steamships and railroads without once passing from the protecting hollow of Mr. Morgan's hand." What would happen when these owners of owners began owning one another? Morgan already owned Perkins. Who would be the ultimate ruler of the American economy? "Is it possible," Baker asked, "that the time will come when an imperial M will repose within the wreath of power?" As if in answer to his question, the Roman initials TR were emblazoned on the sides of White House carriages. In mid-November, the leaders of the Senate began to return to town, many on complimentary railroad passes signed by Hill or Harriman, and paid courtesy calls on the president. Mark Hanna took a look at his message typescript and reacted even more negatively than Perkins. "I see dynamite in it." He objected in particular to the heated tone of Roosevelt's language against overcapitalization. Phrases such as baleful evils, despotism, and storm centers of financial disturbance would not go down well on Wall Street, while inevitable depression, reduced wages, and mismanagement and manipulation might imperil the current détente between capital and labor. Other senators proposed other changes. None seemed to notice that for every word the president had written in criticism of bad trusts, there were 5 in praise of good. Gradually, reluctantly, he erased adjectives, then sentences, then whole paragraphs. He suppressed his condemnation of price-fixing and preferential rebates. He withdrew a proposal to make corporate records subject to government scrutiny. He even crossed out his wish for a constitutional amendment to confer on the national government the power to supervise great industrial combinations. The senators were still not satisfied. They were the legislative veterans, he the executive novice, dependent on their support in consolidating his presidency. So he continued to cut, now pages at a time. Restrained as he might have become on matters of trust policy, Roosevelt remained outspoken on the subject of appointments. His daily public reception, held at noon in George Cortelyou's antechamber, amounted to a patronage mart, and he reveled in the opportunity to show off the decisive speed of his mind. "Tell me what you have to say, quickly, quickly." No matter how concise the request, he was always ready with a reply, and not always the one hoped for. Senator DeBow, "Mr. President, I have Collector Sapp's resignation in my pocket, but..." Roosevelt, "You have? I'll take it. Here, Mr. Cortelyou, wire Mr. Sapp that his resignation has been accepted, and ask him to turn the office over to his first deputy at once. Have someone telephone the Treasury." Over his shoulder, moving on, "That's all right, Senator. Everything will be promptly attended to." He would whirl on round the room, pumping hands and grinning, ejaculating his automatic, "Glad to see you," and "Delighted," like snorts from a steam engine. Office seekers learned not to trifle with his memory, "Haven't you a jail record?" nor to present him with trumped-up dossiers of support. "Petition? I could get a petition to have you hanged." Those other White House pests, the murmurers of special requests, found Roosevelt impossible to buttonhole. Like an actor, he projected his voice past them, at the crowd. The more furtive his interlocutor, the louder he responded, and he took care to repeat fortissimo any request that he deemed improper. The effect was of salt poured on slugs. Even as the supplicants melted away, Roosevelt's voice would follow. "Senator Depew, do you know that man going out? Well, he is a crook." There were days when the visitors besieging him were so numerous that Cortelyou had to empty the antechamber 5 times before lunch. On such occasions, the president could be overstimulated, and his frankness coarsened to rudeness. "I don't give a damn for the legislature of Texas," he roared at Senator Joseph Bailey, making a lasting Democratic enemy. He called to an aide over the heads of Representative John Dalzell and Senator Julius Caesar Burroughs. "Come here, Mr. McEnany, and help me with these 2 gentlemen. They are boring me about appointments." Burroughs left the White House angrily, muttering, "This young man won't last long." Monitors of Roosevelt's Western patronage noticed that an ability to shoot straight seemed to appeal to him more than strict fidelity to the Bill of Rights. Civil Service Commissioner William Dudley Folk recorded his interview with Pat Garrett, slayer of Billy the Kid and candidate for customs collectorship of El Paso, Texas. Roosevelt: "How many men have you killed?" Garrett: 3. Roosevelt: "How did you come to do it?" Garrett: "In the discharge of my duty as a public officer." Roosevelt, looking pleased: "Have you ever played poker?" Garrett: "Yes." Roosevelt: "Are you going to do it when you are in office?" Garrett: "No." Roosevelt: "All right, I am going to appoint you, but see you observe the civil service law." The appointment dismayed many Texans, not because of Garrett's bloody record, but because he was an agnostic. "In El Paso," the president said approvingly, "the people are homicidal but orthodox." On 18 November 1901, Secretary of State Hay and the British ambassador, Lord Pauncefote, signed their long-negotiated treaty granting the United States exclusive right to build an interoceanic waterway in Central America. 2 days later, the Isthmian Canal Commission, appointed by President McKinley to recommend the most practicable and feasible route, reported in favor of Nicaragua. This news was held for release after the opening of Congress, but William Randolph Hearst got an advance copy of the report and splashed it across the pages of his New York Journal. It was a big scoop, if not much of a story. Popular and congressional sentiment had been in favor of a Nicaragua canal for so long that the commission's decision was expected. Panama might possibly have been chosen, but that fetid little Colombian province was already a monument to the folly of French canal engineers. After 22 years of mismanagement, scandal, disease, and death, all that was left of Ferdinand de Lesseps's Grand Canal du Panama was a gang of lethargic workers, some crumbling buildings and rusty machinery, and an immense muddy scar reverting to jungle. Nicaragua, in contrast, offered a virgin landscape, a healthy climate, 100 miles of navigable fresh water, and the lowest pass in the Cordilleras. Its leaders were unanimously eager to reach an agreement with the United States, whereas those of Colombia were divided by civil war, unable to treat with their own rebels, let alone representatives of a foreign power. And yet, this was Hearst's real news, one sentence in the report implied that the commission was not wholehearted about its recommendation. "There are certain physical advantages, such as a shorter canal line, a more complete knowledge of the country through which it passes, and lower cost of maintenance and operation in favor of the Panama route, but the price fixed by the Panama Canal Company for the sale of its property and franchises is so unreasonable that its acceptance cannot be recommended by this commission." Minus that extra compensation, $109 million, a Panama Canal would cost $156 million, as opposed to $200 million for a Nicaragua canal. And it would be finished sooner, thanks to the French excavations. So mere economics had kept the commissioners from endorsing the private preference of the President of the United States. Roosevelt finished reading his revised message aloud to the cabinet on 22 November, All 25,000 words were his own work. Previous presidents had done little more than to collate and introduce the reports of executive departments. But he was still a writer, with a writer's reluctance to sign prose he had not composed, or at least edited. Feeling a sudden revulsion for the ink-stained typescript, he sent it off to be printed. 12 days still intervened before the reassembly of Congress. He decided that he wanted to be alone with his family for a while, somewhere away from Washington. The executive yacht Sylph was rigged, and Navy Yard cannons primed for a 21-gun salute. By 3:30 that afternoon, the Roosevelts were on their way up Pennsylvania Avenue. Passers-by were touched to see the president kissing 4-year-old Quentin, first on one chubby cheek, then the other. Back in Minnesota, James J. Hill saluted his own child, Mary, in his own fashion, with $20 in gold. He had earned them during his first few days as president of the Northern Securities Company. "It is the hardest job I have ever undertaken," he said, in the voice of a man whose ambitions were complete. While the Sylph cruised the lower Potomac through chill salt mists, Americans browsed a syndicated newspaper article entitled Teddy's Horoscope. The astrologist author noted that Theodore Roosevelt had become president under a remarkable coincidence of Capricorn and Aquarius. This meant that, beginning in 1902, his administration would bring about many changes, particularly with respect to laws and treaties. He would increase the nation's military power and go on to handle vast political problems, the like of which we do not dream of today. Although Roosevelt was a man much influenced by Mars, he was likely to be peaceable in foreign affairs. His aggression would spill out on the domestic front, but he would be asking for trouble if he tried to bully Congress. There was likely to be a remarkable recrudescence of social violence soon. While some years of prosperity lay ahead, a crash is surely coming, and securities will drop to rock bottom. The president need not worry about ill health or assassination, but he was fated to suffer the death of some intimate friend or cabinet official, probably the latter. John Hayes, of vuncular fondness for Theodore Roosevelt, had become almost grandfatherly as he watched him struggle toward statesmanship. The president, he wrote a friend, was a young fellow of infinite dash and originality. Although Hay was sometimes embarrassed by Roosevelt's gaucheries, he forgave them as folie de jeunesse. Youth, as the president kept saying, was a curable disease. How boyish of Theodore not to notice, that final freezing Friday before Congress assembled, that the cabinet room fire was unlit and that some of his older officers were still in their overcoats. And how charmingly unpretentious, when he at last did notice, to light the logs himself and coax them to flame. Chapter 4. A Message from the President. On the one hand, I would stamp them underfoot. On the other hand, not so fast. Shortly before noon, on Tuesday, 3 December 1901, a committee of senators and representatives called upon the president. They announced that the 57th Congress was in session and ready to receive any communication he might want to make. The delegation bowed out and returned to Capitol Hill by official carriage. After a polite interval, one of Roosevelt's own monogrammed vehicles followed. It drew up outside the House of Representatives, and a White House secretary jumped out with an enormous manila envelope. Octavius L. Pruden had carried 30 presidential messages up the Capitol steps, but this was the heaviest yet. It consisted of 2 duplicate 80-page volumes, one for the House, one for the Senate. Each was silk-lined, leather-bound, gold-stamped, and sealed with the presidential wafer. A Secret Service man, marching beside Pruden, kept guard over the precious cargo. Actually, the content of Roosevelt's message was the worst-kept secret since the Declaration of Independence. For at least 6 weeks, White House guests had been treated to stentorian readings of the author's favorite passages. Newspaper presses across the country held every word in cold type, and in Britain and Europe the message was already being published and commented on. Even so, Congress was tense with anticipation when Pruden appeared at the door of the House and announced a message from the President of the United States. Speaker David B. Henderson took delivery of the first volume and broke its seal. He was surprised to see printed text instead of the traditional formal copperplate. A reading clerk took it from him and flicked through to the end. "Yes, sir, it is signed." Henderson shrugged. The clerk intoned Roosevelt's opening sentence. "The Congress assembles this year in the shadow of a great calamity." There was an immediate reaction. Presidential messages were supposed to begin blandly, with hackneyed phrases about the United States being at peace with mankind. But as the clerk continued to read, it was clear that Roosevelt was all business. William McKinley, he said, was the victim of a chillingly modern breed of assassin. Lincoln and Garfield had been martyrs for the kind of government they stood for. Today's political killer wanted to destroy government itself. Roosevelt began to eulogize his predecessor, but rage against Czolgosz diverted him into a magnificent 6-minute tirade against anarchism and those who abused the First Amendment by inciting it. The reading clerk could not help but perform histrionically, "The wind is sowed by the men who preach such doctrines, and they cannot escape their responsibility for the whirlwind that is reaped. If ever anarchy is triumphant, its triumph will last for but one red moment, to be succeeded for ages by the gloomy night of despotism." The House sat rapt as Roosevelt demanded federal jurisdiction over attacks on the presidential line of succession and a ban on all politically violent immigrants. "They and those like them should be kept out of this country, and if found here, they should be promptly deported to the country whence they came, and far-reaching provision should be made for the punishment of those who stay. The American people are slow to wrath, but when their wrath is kindled, it burns like a consuming flame." At this, the spell over the listening representatives broke. The sound of their applause rolled after Pruden as he hurried down the corridor to make his second delivery. The Senate, in contrast to the brilliantly lit House, was not yet illuminated for business. Dull winter sunshine seeped through the glass roof, too faint to reach the floor. Pruden hesitated in the doorway, while senators settled like shadows into their chairs. A page relieved the messenger of his burden. Not until it was placed on the chief clerk's lectern did somebody throw a switch. Roosevelt's first words were heralded by a flood of incandescent light. For a quarter of an hour, the seated company listened silently. Paper-bound off-prints of the message, another novelty, were distributed, and senators began following the text like dutiful pupils. "During the last 5 years, business confidence has been restored, and the nation is to be congratulated because of its present abounding prosperity." Mark Hanna sat nodding solemnly at his own revisions. Henry Cabot Lodge, the president's best friend, lounged nearby, looking, as usual, as if he was about to go to sleep. But every now and again he unscrewed his fountain pen and endorsed a passage that appealed to him. "The captains of industry who have driven the railway systems across this continent, who have built up our commerce, who have developed our manufactures, have on the whole done great good to our people." As Roosevelt swung into his much-edited subsection on trusts, Senator John Coit Spooner, Republican, Wisconsin, got up and walked across the room. Spectators in the press gallery watched the small, pigeon-toed figure, guessing that it would stop at one of three desks. These, and Spooner's own, were the four corners of Republican power on Capitol Hill. Spooner, at 58, had the fastest mind, best constitutional knowledge, and most lethal wit in Congress. No senator could match him in debate. He was a scholar of classical rhetoric, and when short of a riposte, which was seldom, he could quote from Cicero or John Wilkes. He was equally dangerous as a listener, specializing in gadfly questions that stung ponderous orators. His very appearance stamped him as unique. In a chamber luxuriant with beards and mustaches, Spooner's clean, chiseled features glowed pale as stone. It was an arresting, almost shocking face, with an imperious twitch to the nostrils. Great waves of hair, polished pince-nez, and oversized cravats softened the cold sculpture. They suggested a frustrated actor. If so, the part Spooner most longed to play was that of President of the United States. But he had always been too spontaneous and too impatient for campaign teamwork. Solo improvisation suited him better. His perambulation ended at the desk of William Boyd Allison, Republican, Iowa. Stooping, he began to whisper in the old man's ear. Rooseveltian rhetoric continued to echo over their heads. Many of those who have made it their vocation to denounce the great industrial combinations known as trusts appeal especially to hatred and fear. The whole history of the world shows that legislation will generally be both unwise and ineffective unless undertaken after calm inquiry and with sober self-restraint. Here were cautious words to appeal to Senator Allison, if Spooner's whispering allowed him to hear them. Throughout his political career, the old fox had counseled due process in lawmaking. His genius was the resolution of discord. His vanity was to affect humility. Not once in his 72 years had he expressed a public point of view. Colleagues joked that if the road from Des Moines to Washington was a piano keyboard, Allison could run all the way without ever striking a note. This legere-de-pied kept him from being beholden to anybody, while gratifying everybody. When legislation arose to favor the urban East, Senator Allison modified it so as not to alienate the rural West. If Southern Democrats forced bills upon him to benefit their poorer constituents, he attached innocent-looking amendments and profited Wall Street as well. But his moderating did not make him moderate. Like Spooner, Allison was a Hamiltonian fiscal conservative. Poised in his equilibrium, he was upset by any shock and could lash out with the sudden bitchiness of old age. Friends forgave him these outbursts. They knew he was tormented by a swelling prostate. Allison's weary shuffle, his dark brown, nicotinous smell, the very breath of the antebellum, guaranteed deference in a chamber worshipful of seniority. All this is true, and yet it is also true that there are real and grave evils. In the front row of the chamber, beneath the reading clerk, sat a senator even hoarier than Allison. At 74, Orville H. Platt, Republican, Connecticut, was the éminence grise of the Republican leadership. No relation to Thomas C. Platt of New York, Roosevelt's ancient enemy, senescent now in a forgotten corner. He served as the Senate's spiritual mentor, its legislative and ethical conscience. There was something Lincoln-esque about Platt's grooved, bearded face and the awkwardness of his 6-foot-4-inch frame. Scholarly, mild, logical, and reclusive, Platt was almost a caricature of New England bookishness. His idea of an amusing evening was to read Greek to his wife. But the mildness was deceptive. Few senators worked more aggressively on behalf of big business. "There is a widespread conviction," the clerk declaimed, "that combination and concentration should be not prohibited, but supervised, and within reasonable limits controlled, and in my judgment this conviction is right." Spooner returned to his seat. The outburst that none of Roosevelt's advisers had been able to suppress was coming. "It is no limitation upon property rights or freedom of contract to require that when men receive from government the privilege of doing business under corporate form, they shall do so upon absolutely truthful representations. Great corporations exist only because they are created and safeguarded by our institutions, and it is therefore our right and duty to see that they work in harmony with these institutions." If Nelson W. Aldrich, Republican, Rhode Island, deduced that Roosevelt was sounding the keynote of his presidency, he showed no sign. The 60-year-old manager of the United States looked as he always did, big, handsome, placid, nonchalantly powerful. His brow was calm, his silvery mustache stiff, his black eyes steady on the page before him. The first essential in determining how to deal with the great industrial corporations is knowledge of the facts, publicity. Aldrich's was a classic poker face. Indeed, he was champion of a private poker game at which he, Spooner, Allison, and Platt formulated policy. So elite was this little circle, so doubly dedicated to cards and politics, that its interests tended to fuse. The house would deal tariff schedules, pension bills, and aces of clubs interchangeably. Most evenings, Aldrich collected. His power derived in part from natural authority, in part from pure memory. Spooner was quicker, and the two senior members were perhaps wiser, but none could match Aldrich's command of information, no matter how raw the data, ore piles of statistics, a rubble of currency regulations. He processed them with the silent efficiency of a kiln. Consequently, he was the Senate's ranking expert on such subjects as paper money circulation, railroad bonds, and free wool. His actions on these issues did not usually make headlines, but Aldrich never cared for publicity. Roosevelt, in contrast, seemed to equate it with democracy. In the interest of the public, the government should have the right to inspect and examine the workings of the great corporations. As far as Aldrich was concerned, news was noise, an intrusive bedlam that disturbed the quiet condominium of government and economy. The more attention public servants enjoyed, the more they would want to be seen to be doing, at the expense of free entrepreneurs. The nation should, without interfering with the power of the states in the matter itself, also assume power of supervision and regulation over all corporations doing interstate business. Aldrich believed that, on the contrary, the nation could do with a little supervision and regulation by businessmen. He was himself a successful railroad executive. "I would undertake to run this government for $300 million a year less than it is now run for," he said. Since this was not constitutionally possible, he could at least control the United States Senate to a greater degree than it had ever known. With a majority of 55-31, and a